Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 76, section 5, which is down there at the bottom of old single column, page 851. So we have this final bit about the second garden. It's really not so much about the second garden, but the last details about Adam and Eve themselves. And all of this is immediately relevant, as I've been saying, that the more they are kind of wrapping up the Adam and Eve story proper, the more they're transitioning into the beginnings of all of those millennia that follow between them and the beginnings of recorded history. Specifically, the thread, the human thread that comes down directly from them gives rise to what are known as the Andites. The answer to all the mysteries of, what lies beyond that curtain, in the mists of time, that curtain of the beginning of recorded history. So they're definitely going to be focusing on that, but there's also just that little issue of wrapping up a few of the loose ends of exactly how their mortality, now that they're mortal, how their mortality plays out, how what happens to them after they die, how exactly does that play forward? And of course, for those people who know this last part of this paper, you know that this is where we get that little tidbit about Michael's seventh bestowal. Gets tossed into vague stream of awareness of human history clear back in the days of Adam and Eve, long, long, long before Michael actually arrived. We're treated with a little portion of a message to Adam and Eve from Michael. So let's see. I think that's pretty much, as you can see, like I was saying, I mean, they've already introduced the preceding section was entitled The Violet Race. So like I said, it's definitely, they're in that mode of the Violet Race, the Adamites leading to the Andites. And that's going to now officially sort of launch into play when Adam and Eve are no longer there. So let's see how the final steps play out here.
Section 5, Death of Adam and Eve. Not long after the establishment of the second Eden, Adam and Eve were duly informed that their repentance was acceptable, and that while they were doomed to suffer the fate of the mortals of their world, they should certainly become eligible for admission to the ranks of the sleeping survivors of Urantia. They fully believed this gospel of resurrection and rehabilitation, which the Melchizedek so touchingly proclaimed to them. Their transgression had been an error of judgment and not the sin of conscious and deliberate rebellion.
Okay, so I remember how they've brought this up a few times, sort of stages to this disclosure of exactly what's going to become of them. They've got all these question marks in their mind. What's going to become of them post-default? So here, like I said, the final loose ends on that. And so their quote-unquote repentance was acceptable. And it's kind of interesting, just that they use that sort of theological sort of terminology like that. Reminding us that even though the notions that humans have tied to such words aren't genuine, aren't true, there's nonetheless a truth that flows through. such favorable conditions of mind, behind genuine repentance, are favorable conditions like what?
Being humble.
Humble, right. Sincere, right. Right. No matter how much falderall is up front, if there's some genuineness behind it that ties to those foundational favorable conditions, right, the universe works with that, and you move forward. It's kind of interesting. Then immediately, while they were doomed, so that's kind of an interesting heavy word to throw in there, but it reminds you of the bigger they are, the harder they fall, basically, right? I mean, they're falling from a relatively high estate, from our perspective of things, so it's hence the strength of the word, but just using our words like fate, as well. The revelators often will kind of speak in the way we speak about things, and they're just in challenging you to not interpret it in some juvenile way, right? But to see how, despite our notions of the fates and such things, luck and chance and that sort of thing. There's a validity to the behind a lot of those words that can be drawn upon. Okay. But you notice here at this point, it's like they are being quite humble, right? They're not going to presume anything beyond the minimum, right? They should certainly become eligible for admission to the ranks of the sleeping survivors of Urantia. They're not going to assume they're a third circler or anything like that. They're not going to assume a special a resurrection, or even that they might get that sort of quasi-special one of a millennial resurrection. It's like, no, okay, we'll sleep for however many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, and we'll get resurrected in a dispensational resurrection. That's a very positive sign that they're being humble like that. We know that they they've gotten ahead of themselves several times. Anyway, then again, just notice the way they say it in terms that's sort of so historically familiar to us. They fully believed this gospel of resurrection and rehabilitation. That's just kind of an interesting thing about that paragraph. The way they are, speaking of them in the same way that we've always spoken about ourselves. They are just very much like the rest of us, in that whole mix of doubt and question and mystery and grasping for anything that seems solid to hold on to assuage your fears.
And yet they were lived in Jerusalem. They must have seen all kinds of people.
Yeah.
They must have known more than believe. They must have seen and experienced it. I mean, it's like, wouldn't you think?
And why wouldn't you believe? Like Don's point, like a Melchizedek, as if you would doubt what one of those is saying.
They got ahead of themselves a little bit, but they've been humbled back to the mode that you so often see the revelators speak in when they talk about something. And if they don't have fully every iota from beginning to end, hands-on, direct knowledge of something, they won't presume to speak definitively about it. So often they'll speak in qualified terms in the book, and you're thinking, like, there's anything to be qualified about there. You know, it seems logically inescapable, you know, what the Revelator is suggesting might be the case. And you think, well, why are they being so hesitant to, you know, just say it definitively? It's because, you know, the basic mode they try to stay in is a very, very humble one. And, you know, unless they have very hands-on, tangible understanding of the physics of something, you know, they won't presume, because they know there's lots of physics that goes beyond the finite and can inject itself into the finite in mysterious ways, in unforeseen ways and stuff. You know, must have something to do with the inscrutable, you know, dot, dot, dot. You know, they'll say something like that, right? So you can see they're reminding us that Adam and Eve have gotten back into that mode, where they, you know, they know they need to stay between the lines because they're way down in the scheme of things, and they can't assume that they have the big picture necessary for a lot of sallying forth on their own, right? Just, you know, running headlong, you know, in some direction that seems appropriate. Okay, anyway. You know, and just to touchingly proclaim to them, all of it is just so interesting the way they speak that way. And then to boot, they even use the word transgression, right? In that final sentence, like transgression of taboo, right? Being sin. So the whole thing is constructed in this way, sort of playing off of the human mode of trying to deal with these issues, and to remind you that they are definitely in your place now. You know, and just as many mysteries are really in play for them as they are for any of us. Then they, at the very end there, what we've talked about many times, it's not rebellion because it isn't deliberate disloyalty to deity. Right? It's not sin of the conscious and deliberate, right? Like they're saying there. But it is, remember, there's evil. Right, it was disloyalty to deity. It just wasn't deliberate disloyalty to deity. And so there's the error that stems from that evil. And so here, when they say an error of judgment, it isn't merely error. Right? And you know, even though it doesn't say so here, but you know, you can go back and, right, they told us before it was definitely evil. So it is. It's that kind of error, the error that stems from evil, not merely error, like not just merely the error that a Melchizedek can get confused in, right, and need a little correction. Right? Melchizedek can't get to evil, but they can get to merely error. Adam and Eve can get to evil. They could have even gotten to sin, but they didn't go that far, just to evil. All right. Okay, so that's, even though it's a very straightforward statements in general, just the way they constructed that, see, is kind of fascinating to think about how they're using our language to so that we think of them as one of us, because they are now. I mean, really, their whole pre-existent life is, you know, is in many ways apart from them, right? I mean, they've been born again, a human, right? They were stationary and then, you know, a little bit descending. Now that's all done, right? That's all in the past. They started from square one basically as an ascender. They're just about to state that directly here in the next paragraph.
Adam and Eve did not, as citizens of Gerasim, have thought adjusters, nor were they adjuster and dwelt when they functioned on Urantia in the first garden. But shortly after their reduction to mortal status, they became conscious of a new presence within them, and awakened to the realization that human status, coupled with sincere repentance, had made it possible for adjusters to indwell them. It was this knowledge of being adjuster and dwelt that greatly heartened Adam and Eve throughout the remainder of their lives. They knew that they had failed as material sons of Satania, But they also knew that the paradise career was still open to them as ascending sons of the universe.
Okay. Again, you know, not as extensively as the preceding paragraph, but, you know, saying it that way, sincere repentance, again. So, you know, again, speaking in our terms a bit. But here's, you know, remember we, I alluded to this statement way back, right? I mean, that most likely why Adam, you know, came back in from his wandering in the wilderness is he became aware of this, of his adjuster, okay? And, you know, and that sort of reset things, and they went forward from there. See, in the way they say that there, but shortly after their reduction to mortal status. So, you know, they were reduced to mortal status instantly. So that's why it's pretty likely that's what that event is. Very shortly thereafter, they get their adjusters.
So, however, you know, we, and even when Jesus got his, of course, we get him at such a young age, are not aware.
Right.
And but because they're so much older, and they just, but we would have been aware had we been the apostles of getting the Spirit of Truth, because it was different than what, you know, than before they didn't have it. But we don't, we're not necessarily aware of that either.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally, you know, a human is aware. You know, and that can be really problematic if they're aware when their adjuster arrives. It tends to become a very problematic, delusional situation for them. But like you said, I mean, in general, we don't because of two reasons. We're young, in general, get it. And two, we just don't have the kind of objective awareness to notice a change in the upper domain, the hourglass analogy of our mind. Our consciousness is mostly just in that lower domain, and anything could be happening up there in the upper domain, and we're just oblivious to it.
So okay. Even before, you know, before Michael, Jesus came here, mm-hmm. when people would get it because they made some supreme choice later on in life, mm-hmm. or, you mm-hmm. know, something happened that caused them to get it as thought adjuster, if, one, would you contemplate that they become aware, you think, or maybe not?
You couldn't say one, definitively one way or another. It's going to depend on the individual. You know, like the revelators say, you know, if you can trust everything beyond the dead level of consciousness, right, it's best. I mean, you don't have to be conscious of any of this. It's the important part is done in a purely superconscious way for this short little life on this nativity sphere, you know, and then you don't have to deal with handling, you know, any awareness and not flying off on a tangent. But, you know, definitely in Adam and Eve's case, I mean, they have such a significant objective consciousness, they're going to immediately notice, right, you know, a change in the upper domain, right, you know, where they're encircled in the Holy Spirit. I mean, they're going to recognize that. And it's just, you know, the way they said it, you know, a new presence within them. Okay, I mean, that definitively. It's like, you know, I don't know, there's something vague. No, it's a very definitive, right, presence within them that they became conscious of. Right? So it's going to be extremely rare for a human to have such a, you know, a stable, objective, definitive recognition like that. They're going to get this intense lightning bolt, like flash, right, from, you know, seem like it came from beyond, you know, whereas, you know, they've got a very stable presence up there in their objective mind, okay, and something joins them there. So they're greatly heartened, you know, and they're facing the words full on. They had failed You know, so they don't beat around the bush, just say it directly. But they also knew that the paradise career was still open to them as ascending sons of the universe. The interesting thing about that is how it's flipped around. You know, we so often talk about how we end up being biased. You know, if it's not a finality, it's, well, it's kind of lesser in our eyes, right? you know, but they don't start that way. I mean, their initial bias is their mode is like the coolest mode of all. You know, so they're settling for, you know, becoming an ascender and becoming a finaliter, right? Have to get themselves acclimated to that mode of relationship to the cosmos. So that's kind of fun to see it flipped around like that.
But isn't that also, the real goal of a material son and daughter? And, you know, in the end,
yeah, but
they can get there.
Right, but again, see, they don't want to have any sort of tension about that, because they may have to serve for countless billions of years, right? You know, before, you know, they would ever even have a chance of being an ascender, right? So
angels too,
and angels too, right? So you know that they're trained and they all kind of work on just putting that totally out of their mind, because they don't want to have that tension polluting their ministry as a stationary son or a descending son, you know, or with an angel, you know, their descending ministry as ministering spirits. Right, I mean, if you're constantly thinking, all right, I'll deal with that worthless blob of protoplasm, Chris, you know, but I really would love to just think about myself and get on with my ascension, right? I mean, they can't be in that mode, right? Obviously. So there's that, you know, like I said, there's that passage. So they were kind of just rehashing that they got their adjusters, and so they were reasonably cool about things from that point on. So that helped them to deal with their children being taken away and all the rigors of the second garden and all that, like we talked about before.
Kids left on the planet were going to be ascenders.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Can't be too swayed one way or the other.
But, you know, it, like we said, I mean, even though it kind of appears that what else could happen but what happened to them,
yeah.
Some of the things they say earlier on makes you suspicious that with their greater experience of how many different things have happened in the universe of universes,
yeah.
You know, there maybe are lots of different modes that this is dealt with. They might have, like one possible, maybe they know of cases where the Adam and Eve were removed from the world, say,
mm-hmm.
you know, or something, or, you know, who knows? There's probably a zillion and one different variations. Anyway.
I have a question.
Yep.
This is a little bit off topic, but it's pretty much the same. So as we as humans, you know, there's this difference between when the book tells you several times, you know, not to, it's not to worry so much about whether you're going to be resurrected after death or whatever.
Take your salvation for granted.
And that's a faith thing, in a way, for me, anyway. There's a difference between that and the degree of humility that, you know, when you're the humbleness aspect thing, you know, borders on the worthiness aspect. And that plays, you know, sort of tension-wise with the whole faith aspect of, you know, well, I'm definitely going to be resurrected, etc., blah, 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 but, you know, but then I want to be humble about it. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference there between having faith or confidence or whatever you want to call it, that I'm okay, and the other side being humble about, well, you know, I don't want to take all these things for granted. So do you see what I'm going with this? I mean, it's not an easy thing sometimes. I'm sure we all go through that wondering in our own life.
Well, the way that you can balance that out, knowing what you now know with the fifth epical revelation, is that when they tell you can take your salvation for granted, that's, you can take it for granted that you're going to get off this planet and get to the first mansion world. But you need to remind yourself, but I'm still immortal on the mansion worlds. I'm immortal until I fuse. And right up to the moment I fuse, I can turn at right angles, okay, and drive myself to iniquity if I really will, okay. So you, that's where you remain humble. It's like, yes, okay, because of Pentecost and the grace, of the consequences of Michael's seventh bestowal. It's a given that I'm going to get off this planet. Okay, but it's not a given that I'm going to fuse with my adjuster. So until I'm grown to that point of fusion, I need to continue to humbly supply favorable conditions, like being humble. All right, so there's so many wonderful things about the mansion worlds, so that we don't have to try to cram all of this into some rationalization scheme here. To have that so that it all can play out in a more reasonable way, the way we think this through. And in terms it's really impossible to be that humble when animal fear is still the major driving force in your mind. See, and if you think about it, that animal fear is only about that first death, your death here, and getting to some next life. I mean, animal fear isn't an issue about getting from the first mansion world to the second mansion world. You're a Mraja being, okay? So you don't have that, literally still energized animal fear like we do here. So, see, if you can take that, that your survival of this life for granted, that can help you to get control of your animal fear and allows you to go beyond sort of tentative favorable conditions. Like I said, I mean, you're only going to be able to be so loyal, so humble, so sincere, et cetera, when you're still driven by fear. I mean, why do so many people go to disloyalty? Because of fear, why, et cetera. I mean, why do they become impatient? Because they're afraid. That fear is a poison to anything beyond some sort of fleeting, tentative, favorable conditions. You've got to get control of that fear. So that's why you should just definitively take your salvation for granted. Period. End of story. So that. That fear can be just driven out of your mind. There is no need to be afraid in that regard anymore. That's done. You can read the Old Testament now, and it's not going to reanimate your fear. Right? It's like, oh boy, I don't know. There's that capital J judge, and I,
it's almost like Jesus died for my sins, so. I don't have to worry about anything, that kind of thing.
Right,
it never made much sense to me.
Paul tried to deal with this. It's like, okay, so people keep mixing the law of God in with the love of God and making God's love relative. Right? It's like, well, he's going to love you if, you check off these tick marks about his law, right? So, they can't get to the absolute love of God because they've got the law blended in with it. It's like, so we're going to stick with the whole sin, sacrifice, and atonement model that humans have always been in, but we're going to say that Jesus is puts the final period, full stop on all that, okay? You now are no longer in debt. Okay? That's the end of that story. you know, and he tried to very definitively get people to move on by trying to, you know, use that whole historical story, but to bring it to a final culmination. But even that, no. I mean, even Christians can't just put an end to that, right? You know, and one of the reasons is because the Old Testament's there in the Bible too. And so it tends to reanimate. Oh, but what about, right? You know, God can't just love me absolutely. What about, you know, you start to think that somehow his love for you is relative to how many crimes you've committed, you know, or how many sins you've committed. Or no, his love has absolutely nothing to do with issues of law, either real or imaginary. Okay? I mean, that's why, I mean, if his love was qualified by those things, it wouldn't be absolute love. Right? Absolute facts don't overlap. Right? They're absolutely separate. Okay? And, you know, humans are still struggling, even with the fifth epical revelation, to get to the absolute love of God. Right, to get to that little vignette with the condemned criminal and be able to separate the law and the love there. Right? Jesus is trying to say, okay, the law is in play with the government who's made a ruling that you need to die for your crimes, etc. Okay, but he's saying that has nothing to do with the love of God for you and how I'm going to minister that love to you person to person, because it's independent of law issues. Okay? He was trying to demonstrate that separation between the love and the law. But, you know, it's very difficult for most, you know, and the reality is most people, if you tried to give them this, it would be a problem. Because the only reason they temper their behavior is because they think that God's love, you know, is predicated on your good behavior, right? You know, and so if you really convince them that it doesn't matter how many crimes you commit, God still loves you absolutely, they go, well, I'm just going to commit all the crimes again. I'm going to go back to killing and raping then. You know, if God loves me independent of those things. So, yeah, I mean, there's a reason why evolution developed this whole, you know, blending of the love and the law together, because humans aren't mature enough. But the fifth epical revelation is looking for people who are mature enough, who can separate their outer life from their inner life, can find the love of God in their inner life, apart from them still conforming with, you know, whatever mores or laws or whatnot there is for their outer life. Yep.
That many Christians kind of get this idea of love, that God loves them absolutely. But they're so focused on social justice that drags them into law issues.
Right, because again, they're going to drag God out of the inner life, you know, into some God of social justice against. I mean, they're blurring the love and the law together. It doesn't mean that you don't have issues relative to law. It doesn't mean there aren't issues of social justice, like I've said many times here recently. But that's separate. The love of God has absolutely nothing to do with any of that stuff. It's like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Every notion I have of the love of God has a lot to do with that stuff. Well, then you haven't found the love of God yet. That's what I'm trying to say. Until you've found something that has absolutely no overlap with your outer life, you haven't found the love of God. Right? You're looking for something that stands absolutely apart from your outer life.
And God loves everyone.
Yeah. Because we all know that, you know, all of our basic differences have to do with our differences in the outer life. And if God doesn't relate to that outer life, if he relates to your inner life, that's why he's no respecter of persons. But again, you're only a person in that upper domain of the hourglass analogy. Right? you're a fancy animal in the lower domain that's related to your outer life. It's only in the upper domain that it's a personalized self. That's the only place that God relates to. So that's the only place an adjuster can be. Adjuster has no relationship to the lower domain. It doesn't have any relationship to issues of time. Oh, adjuster, help me with my parking space. Right? It doesn't have anything to do with such things. Right? Any more than the guardians of your destiny, the angels have anything to do with your parking space. Right? Right? The adjuster and the angel are engaged to each other in this very mysterious way. Well, if the adjuster is only in the upper domain, then where's the angel engaging you? Only in the upper domain. The angel's not relating to your outer life. Okay. And they tell you if angels ever get ordered to do something relative to your outer life, it's because it has nothing to do with you. Right? It has something to do with the whole. Right? See, again, all of that, can you change the way you've always thought about angels and get this new logically consistent understanding of where they relate to you, where the adjuster relates to you, where God relates to you? It's that unexplored territory. It's that territory that's not talked about in the dictionary, right? That's not talked about in the writings of humans. It's that place that's above feelings. Remember, about the highest thought that anyone has ever had in using the word soul as a word separate from the word mind. I remember initially it was just a synonym for mind. But the highest thing that humans have ever gotten in some rationalization scheme about what the soul is something that's, that goes on after you die, is that the soul is the source of your feelings. See, in other words, that the highest thing that humans can think of is their feelings. And it's like, well, okay, maybe abstractly there could be this thing that it's the source for those feelings. So right now I've got this soul and it's manifesting feelings in this minded body. And then the soul goes on and becomes a source for feelings for some other body. And see, that's as far as humans have gotten. Feelings, nothing more than feelings, right? And you just have this mystical idea that, well, there's maybe something that's slightly transcendent of feelings in the sense that it's the source of feelings. But to imagine that there could be the source of something higher than feelings has never occurred to mankind, right? So, see, that means that so how much consciousness has there been in the upper domain, like Adam and Eve had here, right, where they were aware of this new presence? I mean, we have to be very, honest with ourselves about this. This is a pretty sad tale. It's sad to record, see? And it doesn't say that no persons, it says so few. Yeah, and apparently none of those have written anything. okay, anyway.
Thank you.
Right, it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward, right? You have to transcend those feelings. You have to go to that space that is basically unspoken of in human literature. Right, there are occasional people that have kind of, had vague senses of it, but just to have not a vague notion that kind of gets lost in some mystical musing, have a very literal physics understanding of this. There's this whole definitive place, right, that your consciousness can go. That lies bounded definitively above feelings. And the love of God that you seek is four levels up. Okay? It's not good enough to just go up one notch from feelings. You have to go up four. Right? And initially it seems like you're going in the opposite direction. Right? You go up two from feelings and you get to scientific consciousness. It's like, well, I'm going in the opposite direction. You got to keep going up. Right? That religious consciousness is up four levels from those feelings. Anyway, I always am willing to take these tangents on this because it's until we start attempting to relate to what's in the revelation with these sorts of challenges in mind, you're putting new wine in old wineskins. You're not going to get what the book is telling you. You're going to interpret the word love, for instance, or the word faith in the old way. So you're not going to get any revelation. You'll just appear to get affirmation. Yep, faith is always what I thought it was. The love of God is always what I thought it was. A revelation doesn't tell you what you always thought. A revelation tells you what you never imagined. What no other human has ever told you. Something you can't read in any book. That's what a revelation tells you. All right, let's see. So where were we now? We were with the adjuster. Being adjuster indwelt that greatly heartened. Right? Do you notice that? Heartened Adam and Eve? Right? Remember the material gravity was dragging them down out of the heart. Right? So they mean spiritual gravity, right, is keeping them up, their consciousness up in the heart, up in the upper domain. Now think of that literally. Instead of, oh, they had even more impassioned feelings than they did before. No, that's not what heartened means. Okay.
I've heard of a lot of people like alcoholics or whatever get a sense of God loves them and they become heartened like that. But I don't think on a low level, like they get a glimpse of
it's real. What happens, remember, there's a heart by grace. And humans can get a little flash when they let go. Mm-hmm. Most of us haven't so polluted that upper domain. Right, that instead of finding the presence of God, they find some polluted dogma space. Right, I mean, most people, if something just gets them to humbly let go of themselves for a second, they feel heartened. Right, they feel that refounding of themselves, that re-anchoring of themselves in the cosmos. The anchor never left. They're just their awareness of it left.
But sometimes you feel like you do need a second chance.
And remember, we don't have a just second chance. There's mercy credits more than you could ever use.
Right? And of course, most people aren't looking at tons of mercy credits.
Yeah, but again,
they're happy to have one second chance.
It doesn't matter if there's an infinite number of mercy credits. One little supreme act in a negative way with your will overrules all the mercy credits that God could ever give you. You have free will. You can reject an infinite number of mercy credits with your absolute dimension of your personality. So again, it's up to you to not hold on to yourself with that absolute dimension, self-righteousness, right? But to hold on to God with that absolute dimension. And then all those mercy credits are naturally there, and everything will roll out just fine. Seek first the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of you. Yeah. Okay. All right, so there, what else do they give us here?
Adam knew about the dispensational resurrection, which occurred simultaneously with his arrival on the planet. and he believed that he and his companion would probably be repersonalized in connection with the advent of the next order of sonship. He did not know that Michael, the sovereign of this universe, was so soon to appear on Urantia. He expected that the next son to arrive would be of the Avanal order. Even so, it was always a comfort to Adam and Eve, as well as something difficult for them to understand, to ponder the only personal message they ever received from Michael. This message, among other expressions of friendship and comfort, said, "I have given consideration to the circumstances of your default. I have remembered the desire of your hearts ever to be loyal to my Father's will, and you will be called from the embrace of mortal slumber when I come to Urantia, if the subordinate sons of my realm do not send for you before that time."
Okay. So like I said, there's the little snippet from Michael.
I would embroider that for
every lifetime. Now, on the flip side, though, is, you know, look at the way they introduce it. The only personal message they ever received.
Right,
but it's kind of just funny the way they say that.
A little goes a long way.
Yep. Right.
So beautiful.
You know, but it reminds you of how those above aren't micromanaging all the details down below. They trust in the Father's personalities to play out as they will. Right. So you've got that between the lines there. Okay, before we get to the Michael quote, just again, you see they're re-emphasizing. They're just thinking dispensational resurrection. Not going to presume anything else. They assume the only thing that, you know, that you can without wildly speculating, just like we do. It's like, well, I would think the next son is going to be the magisterial son. Occasionally we talk about, well, it could be anything, who knows, but, you know, that's the most reasonable, straightforward assumption. They're just about to explain the whole part about, you know, if the subordinate sons of my realm do not send for you before that time, they're just about to explain that, so I don't need to unpack that yet. Let's read the next paragraph. But obviously, yeah, you know, the thing that, you know, like they're going to mention that really throws them a loop is, you know, what is this bit about when I come to Urantia? The other little thing in there is, again, notice, I have remembered the desire of your hearts. Okay. So not those desires in the lower domain that got them off track and led to the default, right? There wasn't that deliberate issue where this was willed as a desire in the upper domain. Okay. And that was, remember, that was the whole point. They were getting drugged down and they just, before they knew what was going on, they had lost objective sight over what their lower domain was doing, you know, and in Eve's case, I mean, very literally leading to movements of her body that had consequences. Okay, right. So that again, you know, God only relates to you in the upper domain. So all that guilt stuff, right, that you have in the lower domain, that has nothing to do with God. Okay. God is only judging you by what's in the upper domain, what you've willed there. And you should only judge yourself likewise. And like we were saying, most people have no concept of their real nature in the upper domain, so you shouldn't be judging yourself at all. Just forget about it. Right? Right? That whole guilt, to take your salvation for granted. Don't bring in all that lower domain guilt and issues of the moray system and all that. It doesn't have anything to do with your relationship to eternity. Now, there's things you have to address about, you have a duty right, to the evolutionary state of affairs that you're born into. Yes, okay. But that has nothing to do with eternity, you know, and your relationship is to that eternity as an individual. Keep them separate. But that's a very, very difficult thing. Everyone has always assumed that guilt is related to the law of God, and the law of God, you know, is the predicate for the love of God. So, I mean, right, their guilt tells them that they can't even remotely approach the love of God. It's like, no, it doesn't have anything to do. Right?
How do you think they got this personal message? Obviously, he wasn't there.
Yeah, so, some personal individual brought them, you know, the message. Remember, Gabriel was here, so maybe Gabriel brought it.
Solitary messenger?
Right, I mean, you definitely, yeah, you could have had a solitary messenger bring it, but...
So it's a telepathic thing? Like, they didn't read it to him, right?
Well, again, we don't know any details. I mean, in terms of actually being given this message, did the Melchizedek's give it to them, you know, or... the Melchizedek's unroll a scroll and hear ye. I don't know the details. They aren't explaining them here. But I would think that, I mean, my first guess would not be they're hearing these in their mind. I would think that some being is delivering the message to them, right? Probably the Melchizedek, since they, you know, already set up here, the Melchizedek so touchingly proclaimed to them. I mean, but like I said, Gabriel, I mean, since, you know, remember, where was that back? Where did they mention Gabriel being involved here? Can't even remember where that was. Where was that passage? In the preceding paper in section 7, it was while the Edenic caravan was halted that Adam and Eve were informed of the nature of their transgressions and advised concerning their fate. Gabriel appeared, right, to pronounce judgment. So, I don't know. Anyway, maybe Gabriel gave them an envelope and told them to open it in a few years. It's got a little wax seal on it, and with an M, you know, dented in the wax. I don't know.
You guys need to be sitting down before you open.
Anyway.
I want a message from Michael.
Your job is to be an agendonter, to believe even when you don't get the wax sealed envelope. All right, what else do they say here?
And this was a great mystery to Adam and Eve. They could comprehend the veiled promise of a possible special resurrection in this message, and such a possibility greatly cheered them. But they could not grasp the meaning of the intimation that they might rest until the time of resurrection associated with Michael's personal appearance on Urantia. And so the Edenic pair always proclaimed that a Son of God would sometime come. And they communicated to their loved ones the belief, at least the longing hope, that the world of their blunders and sorrows might possibly be the realm whereon the ruler of this universe would elect to function as the paradise bestowal son. It seemed too good to be true, but Adam did entertain the thought that strife-torn Urantia might, after all, turn out to be the most fortunate world in the system of Satania, the envied planet of all Nebadon.
Yeah, I mean, not just Adania, we're talking all of Nebadon here.
Doesn't seem like he was all that confused. He's pretty spot on.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, that last part reminds you. I mean, they know, right, that there's going to be some world that gets selected for his seventh bestowal. I mean, everyone knows the stories of the first six bestowals, and, you know, and here they're going, oh my goodness, could it be that the seventh bestowal is going to be here? And obviously it's like, well, doesn't seem like could it be. He's just said point blank, right? So, how was it? when I come to your ranch, right? So, now notice that whole bit with the subordinate sons, you know, send you for you before that time. Initially, they're just saying in general special resurrection. We don't know if it's a millennial resurrection or a, you know, actual special one. Remember how we've talked about that a number of times. They'll use special resurrection as a general term for both of those, or as a specific term in distinction from millennial resurrections. Yeah, we'll see here in the next section which it is. But okay, so we've gone. So he's let go of the dispensational, and he's thinking it's going to be one of the two flavors of special. He doesn't know immediately, you know, that it's like, well, is Michael going to come really soon? So like before the Avonal? It's like, well, that would be skipping the step, you know, but then he thinks about what he said. It's like, yes, but he made it clear that there was like two options. Either it's when I come or, you know, when you get a special resurrection. It's like, wow. So see, he's also thinking he's apparently going to skip the magisterial mission. And, you know, he's putting all the pieces together there. Yeah. So that's why, you know, it kind of adds, the facts of it add to the strength of those final things, the most fortunate world, because it's just going to be exception upon exception, a very exceptional world indeed. All right.
One more thing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. At least the longing hope.
Yeah.
And now I'm an Agon doctor, but some of us have that longing hope for the return.
Yeah, yeah. Michael. Yeah, and remember, it's you get a little bit of solace in that. That the Supernafim, you know, is waiting for at any hour. So it's not that we're just hopelessly, you know, hopeful. It's not impossible that it could happen tomorrow.
Some people bank their whole existence on that return.
Right, but we all know that we do need to avoid thinking, it's like, well, if it doesn't happen in my lifetime, it's irrelevant. Right, there is, you know, we remember the whole 100-year thing that we've been talking about so much with Adam and Eve is a big thing we have to all challenge ourselves with.
But we'll get to see what happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No matter when it happens, you'll get to follow it all in detail. You know, and who knows, maybe it's not going to happen for a very long time, and you'll get to Salvington before then. So you'll get to face to face before everyone on this planet does. So, you know, when all is said and done there, you'll be going, wow, I'm glad I didn't have to wait on the planet for it to happen. Right? Instead of waiting for Michael to come to you, you can just go to Michael. Not to mention, who knows, maybe he'll make an appearance, you know, when you're on Adentia or something. Yeah. You don't have to wait until you get all the way to Salvington. All right, so now kind of a little bit back into, kind of the details of Adam and Eve's side. It's like, well, what about things going forward here, with their aging and then eventually dying and leading into what follows?
Adam lived for 530 years. He died of what might be termed old age. His physical mechanism simply wore out. The process of disintegration gradually gained on the process of repair, and the inevitable end came. Eve had died 19 years previously of a weakened heart. They were both buried in the center of the Temple of Divine Service, which had been built in accordance with their plans soon after the wall of the colony had been completed. And this was the origin of the practice of burying noted and pious men and women under the floors of the places of worship.
So you go, whoa, so that's not a new thing. Right? The saints buried under the floors of the cathedral. So it goes all the way back, like so many things, go all the way back to Adam and Eve. And if you ever thinking, well, how could it go back that far? all those millennia, remind yourself just how significant an impact these, you know, 8 foot tall, glowing in the dark pair of beings had on the human consciousness. Right? I mean, it was just an indelible imprint that they left. People religiously, quote unquote, right, carried many things forward from them. And then, of course, the funny thing about that, you know, or the interesting thing about that between the lines is, okay, so did the Midwayers take him out of that tomb and put him in the archive that they've got? Or are they still buried there? Could you dig in some spot in Iraq and find them? You know, and if we dug up 8 foot tall skeletons like that, what would we think? Buried in some really fancy, you know, stone tomb.
Why don't you post on the Arantia thread?
Then
you'll have a whole expedition.
You get Bezos. So yeah. That one's kind of an interesting one. You have to wonder. It's like, well, do you suppose the Midwayers would have taken them out of there and put them in storage? You know, maybe they haven't decayed. Maybe their bodies are preserved. Maybe, you know, eventually we could have access to their DNA.
Ooh.
Or something, see? Who knows?
Juicy possibilities.
Yeah.
Do you think they lived for 530 years after they became mortal, or 530 years from the time they got here?
530 years from the time they got here. Yeah, yeah. Because you know that because they've kind of put you in that mode that's the way they talk about it. Okay. Yeah, right. So, I mean, remember, you got 117.
Yeah, that they didn't
deteriorate. Right. So, one of the first things you notice there is, okay, I mean, even with their fancy genetics, they're not living as long as, you know,
some
people in light and life.
Right. Some of them.
See, so that reminds you right there, like I said, I mean, you don't get to those kind of life longevities by just the biologic uplift. You get, you know, there's got to be some genetic engineering, right? See, Adam and Eve are sort of just demonstrating that. Now, the other little interesting thing, remember when they were talking about Seth, and they said it was 129 years, and in the Bible it has 130? And so it's like, well, the interesting thing is, okay, he actually lived 530. And in the Bible, it's 930. It almost seems like the 30 part actually carried forward, you know, and they either had gotten it mixed up or something, and so the 129 became 130 as well, so they were both 30s. You know, you even have to wonder, it's like, did they actually remember 530, but when they got to telling those stories, remember what I said, those, you know, they'll tell us this when we get into the next paper. You know, when they're saying those people live 900 and some years, those aren't actual trips around the sun. Those are 28-day months, right? You know, and so the 530 might have gotten changed, you know, not that long ago. It's like, well, that can't be correct. It's got to be 930, because otherwise you won't be 70 years and 10, or by reason of strength 40. It won't fall into that, you know, that 70 to 80 range. But yeah, it's interesting, the 30, that it's the actual year is 530, and the Bible's got 930. It's kind of, that makes it suspicious. Anyway, so there's that little tidbit. Yeah, you got it. She died of a weakened heart. I remember they told you what an incredible stress she put on herself.
Yeah. But it took like 400 years to get a weakened heart.
But the fact that they, you know, mentioned, you know, pointed out that there's kind of a point of failure with her, whereas with Adam it was just sort of systemic deterioration. Everything was sort of equally, but there was a focus point for her, so that she died a little bit sooner. Probably residual, like, you know, she said she never fully recovered from the focused stress she put on her body during those days when Adam was off wandering in the wilderness.
Oh, she had a lot of kids.
Yeah, and there's that too. But but anyway, yeah, it seems interesting that they mentioned that. And then the other little thing is, see, the process of disintegration gradually gained in the process of repair. Remember, I brought that up at the end of the preceding section when they were talking about all of that artificial insemination they did of all those women. And we were wondering, why 1,682, you know, why did they stop there? And I was saying, well, maybe there came a point when the quality of his genetics the word they use here is disintegrated too much, and they couldn't do it anymore. You know, maybe that had something to do with it. I'm just guessing. But it's because they actually point out, it's not like he's going along just fine and at 5:30 then, you know, he just dies. They're indicating that there's this ramp down that's happening. So all right. Okay. So that's it. Adam and Eve are now in the tomb. And remember, what's his name? Jansed, isn't it? Jansed, which was Eve's son's son, because Adam lived longer than Eve's son. So it was actually Adam's grandson that took over when Adam died. Became the successor of Adam as the head of the Adamite tribes, is what they say back there. So we're now in this very post-Adam, see, even post-first generation children. So once Adam dies, you're very much kind of in the next much more human-like mode of things. You have this kind of sharp transition that they're about to mention of having any sort of definitive coming down from above representative on the planet. Okay. It's not even second hand, it's third hand, see, with his grandson. So you very much leave all of that Van and the Amadon and the prince's staff before that. All that is very much kind of just all in one moment of his death in the rearview mirror. Okay.
The supermaterial government of Urantia, under the direction of the Melchizedeks, continued, but direct physical contact with the evolutionary races had been severed. From the distant days of the arrival of the corporeal staff of the planetary prince, down through the times of Van and Amadon, to the arrival of Adam and Eve, physical representatives of the universe government had been stationed on the planet. But with the Adamic default, this regime, extending over a period of more than 450,000 years, came to an end. In the spiritual spheres, angelic helpers continued to struggle in conjunction with the thought adjusters, both working heroically for the salvage of the individual. But no comprehensive plan for far-reaching world welfare was promulgated to the mortals of Earth until the arrival of Machaventa Melchizedek in the times of Abraham, who, with the power, patience, and authority of a son of God, did lay the foundations for the further uplift and spiritual rehabilitation of unfortunate Urantia.
Okay, and that was, remember, in 1980 BC. So that's a long time, right? To get from Adam and Eve to 1980 BC with Machaventa Melchizedek. Notice again, we already, you know, when we went off on that little tangent, see, it wasn't that much of a tangent. They actually brought it up right there. The angelic helpers continue to struggle in conjunction with the thought adjusters, you know, both working heroically for the salvage of the individual. Right? They're working relative to the inner life, but no comprehensive plan for far-reaching world welfare was promulgated to the mortal life. And there's no one dealing with the outer life.
Point of becoming Agandantra status for humanity.
Yeah, is finding the inner life in the absence of helpers in the outer life to encourage you to find the inner life.
But was that the exact point of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what an Agandanter is. He is someone who finds the solidity of the inner life without anyone in the outer life, like an Adam and Eve, and saying, seek the inner life. The what? Right? You know, you're not going to naturally look for something that's invisible. Yeah. Right? So, yeah, that's the whole point. You know, you've managed to find... See, and again, extend it beyond this life, you know, through the mansion world, right? You
extend what?
Extend this Agandanter status.
Well, no, we're not going to be Agandanters there.
Yeah, yeah, your Agandanter's on high.
What? Wait a minute.
Yeah, go back and read. Go back and read about the Agandanters, right? Right, just to remind yourself of how important this first life is, right? Even post Pentecost, where like we were saying, okay, now you get an automatically get an adjuster and all this, but still, they're reminding you that you can still go sideways on the first and second mansion worlds. Even though this is post-Pentecost. You want to really think beyond this life and beyond surviving this life. You want to, you know, it's like we were talking about before, John, you know, you want to really set your eyes through all of that immediate animal fear and, you know, foundational stages of your existence in the universe of universes, right? And, you know, really chart a course beyond that. Most people, the most abstract thing that they can imagine is surviving this life. Right? That their imagination sort of ends at that, and so all their stories end at that. You die, and then magically you're standing next to God.
Yeah.
Right. Right, those limited stories is because they're fundamentally limited in their sense of what they are. Right, and so, you know, chart that course through. You need to recognize that your soul has formed in this world in the absence of all that external help, and in ways that we don't fully appreciate, it's... it's colored by that. You still have to persevere, even though you can't see, you know, effectively. Even in the next life, we often talk about this. I mean, don't think that just because you can see angels running around that, you know, it'll all just happen automatically for you. I mean, the non-index go to iniquity, okay? And they see a lot more than just angels running around. Okay, so you have to kind of take it all up a notch and recognize that when all is said and done, it's just you. I mean, if you're thinking about that relationship with the Father, there's only one being in your relationship with the Father. There's no angel helpers. There's no other being there. Father relates to a single individual, you, not you and your group of helpers. Right? You have to find the Father all by yourself when all is said and done. And the helpers are just there for catalysts. They don't do it for you. Yeah.
It's not done for anybody.
Yeah,
ever.
It's not done for anybody. And
so maybe we're better at standing alone.
Yeah, I mean...
Or
There's all kinds of things between the line. You know, go back and reflect on what they say about the Agadanters and think about just how much is really there when you think about it a little more deeply. It's it's the mysteries of what they say about the Agadanters is related to that mystery of why do we have this life anyway? I don't get it. And like in post-Pentecost, it seems even more superfluous, apparently. It's like, well, if I get to the next life automatically, why not just skip this life? What's the point then? See, you could rationalize it that way. I mean, you know, if you think about it that way, it seems even more strange that we even have this life with a material identity. But there's deep mysteries to it. Just remember, if you don't fully have this life, it means you can't become a certain type of being. It's that significant. You can't become a finaliter. And it's not a technicality. Well, I see in your record that you don't, No, I mean, you literally don't embody the stuff that a finaliter is made out of. You know, if you just skip the whole evolutionary process and just imagine building a finaliter, and they gave you a pile of raw material that only spanned the first mansion world to the Isle of Paradise, you couldn't build a finaliter out of that raw material. You could build a paradise citizen, like one of the children that's resurrected in the probationary nursery and ends up being a permanent paradise citizen. You could build one of those out of that stuff, but you can't. You literally don't have the energy stuff, the body stuff, to build a finaliter without the stuff that you accumulate here. Even in that tiny little embryonic soul that you leave here with, it's got a kind of stuff in it. Okay? There's a lot of mystery there.
There's no mechanism from Mansion World 1 on that can compensate that.
Right. And just think about that. Go to the cosmos infinite. In an infinite cosmos, there's no mechanism to somehow get that stuff into existence some other way. God can't snap his fingers and make that. It's impossible. Very fascinating to think about the mystery of this life. Okay, let's see, where were we? We read this paragraph here. What else did we have there? The one thing I wanted to point out. Notice towards the end there, about after the arrival of Machiavelli and Melchizedek in the times of Abraham, who, with the power, patience, and authority of a son of God, etc., patience. See, the patience is there. You got that power and authority thing. You know, that sounds pretty exciting. But none of that is going to be a positive if there isn't the patience there. I'm stressing that because you'll notice something in the next paragraph as well. All right.
was the Melchizedek event resurrection event?
No, that wasn't a dispensational revelation, so there was no dispensational.
Or a special.
Yeah.
Right.
Before we go on, I should just, let's see, or should I wait? No, let's wait a minute. I'll wait till we get to the next section. But you reminded me not to forget something. Okay, go ahead.
Misfortune has not, however, been the sole lot of Urantia. This planet has also been the most fortunate in the local universe of Nebadon. Urantians should count it all gain if the blunders of their ancestors and the mistakes of their early world rulers so plunge the planet into such a hopeless state of confusion, all the more confounded by evil and sin, that this very background of darkness should so appeal to Michael of Nebadon that he selected this world as the arena wherein to reveal the loving personality of the Father in heaven. It is not that Urantia needed a creator son to set its tangled affairs in order. It is rather that the evil and sin on Urantia afforded the Creator Son a more striking background against which to reveal the matchless love, mercy, and patience of the Paradise Father.
Hmm. Got that love and mercy thing. Patience. Same. So, as they're finishing up the story, you know, what was the big issue with Lucifer? What was the big issue with Adam and Eve? Patience. What's the gateway to the upper domain? The level of patience. All right, it's all predicated on patience. It doesn't matter if you're the Universal Father, you're Machiavelli, Melchizedek. It's all predicated on patience. If you're going to have any relationship to the Universal Father, it has to be predicated on what he's predicated on. Patience. Right? If it's not, your relationship to the Father is delusional. As a conscious phenomenon. Sure, by grace, there's a superconscious relationship, right? But, you know, you're looking for that conscious relationship. That conscious relationship with God is inescapably predicated on patience. Your God-likeness, see, is predicated on God's nature, patience. And they're very much stressing it there in those two paragraphs. I wanted to make one other comment. So, see, it doesn't matter if you're talking about, the one end of the spectrum where you talk about love and mercy, or the other end of the spectrum where you talk about power and authority. Notice the wonderful contrast there. There's one thing in common.
Yeah.
Patience. Okay.
Well, I was contemplating on what we gain in this material life. And it has to have something to do with the materiality of it. You know, and what's more directly concerned with material than material gravity? We take it for granted. We rise up out of bed, we don't levitate. We have to push ourselves.
Right, right.
Everything that's alive, that's material, has to work against gravity. There's something about that experience that's essential. And if you think about how the whole cosmos is, materiality of it is as much of a part of the reality of it as the spirit is.
Right.
And all of these universes, all of these worlds are all moving, and you can't speed it up. You can't make it go faster.
Uh-huh.
No, it all goes in its own time. It's what gives us time to start with.
Right.
So how long must I bear with you?
just that fact that when you think, as we've spoken recently about, you know, the spirit gravity and the material gravity in your mind, you know, and how they're in opposite directions, right? I mean, you don't ascend automatically, right? Because there's material gravity, right? You have to choose to ascend. Right, it's just right there in the gravity that there's nothing automatic about getting to the Isle of Paradise. You have to choose to ascend. I mean, you know, remember that the ascension is of the mind, right? Not literal, you know, floating up, you know, in space.
About the experience of material life. If you don't have sufficient differential,
right? You haven't, like I always say, that's the thing about a finality. They embody the full range of choice. You've chosen to overcome the whole range of that which would naturally prevent you from getting there. It would hold you down. You've overruled all of that naturalness, you know, to achieve the Isle of Paradise. Again, it just stresses how unnatural a journey your ascension is. Okay, so the patience thing, I just want to make sure everyone noticed that. And make sure that you don't just remember this passage for the facts of this passage. You know, in fact, it's talking about how the Creator's Son, you know, selected this world because of the contrast. Okay, but that's, you know, of no use to you unless you're wanting to use that to construct your religion about Jesus. Okay, what's the point of this paragraph for you? All right, as he did, you should do likewise. All right, what's, you know, this goes back to the Agendander thing. Why is this life on this world so incredibly valuable? Because the less the actuality, the greater the potentiality. And it's hard to find a lesser actuality in all of reality. Right. You have an opportunity here, just like Michael recognized he did, right, to stand in stark contrast, right, to not just be a drop in the ocean of the outer life of the world, right, to be an individual with an inner life that automatically stands in stark contrast to the darkness that inescapably is the outer life of this world, the external world of this world. Okay, that's your great opportunity. It takes nothing to meet the demands of this outer life. Right? It's a, you know, it might seem like it's demanding, but not really. It's really the smallest actuality has the least demanding thing you could find. You want to find a demanding outer life, go to Havona. Okay, now there is a demanding outer life, right? the economy of Havona is like just beyond our comprehension of how exacting it is. You know, I mean, the number of I's you have to dot and T's you have to cross there in your outer life is just beyond your comprehension, right?
Times a billion. Okay.
But really, you know, this external world is dark. Okay, and because of that, you have the opportunity to stand in brilliant contrast. I mean, the faintest little genuine inner life will glow like an infinite torch in the darkness. Right. Instead. It says, what does it say? You still languish and stumble along in moral darkness. No inner lives. Same color as the outer life. Dark. Right? Right? Your inner life, I mean, your lower domain, I mean, you know, is not your inner life. Right? That lower domain is in interplay with that darkened external world. See that moral darkness. The moral is referring to the upper domain. There aren't lights shining in the darkness, you know. And it's like, well, there's all kinds of examples of people, you know, that are very feelingful in the midst of those who don't care. That's not what light looks like. That's what the revelation is trying to teach us. You're way too quick to be satisfied with people who are feelingful amongst those who aren't. Sure, that's a contrast, but that's not a real contrast. Right?
Vivid heat island.
Okay, that's a mind in contrast to matter. What would it look like if spirit was in contrast to matter? Right? Genuine spiritual light shining in a darkness. That's what they're encouraging us to seek. Right? Something that goes beyond feelings. Something that isn't just heat in contrast to cold. Right? That's what feelings are in contrast to those who don't feel.
Warm and fuzzy?
It's warm and cold. Right? And if you get really worked up, it's hot and cold. Right? If you're a fanatic, right? It's hot and cold. Okay? There's something above that. There's light and dark. And that's what you're looking for, that contrast. Right? The soul is really a source of light, not of heat. It's not a source of feelings. It's a source of light.
You're not going to be there like an automaton with no feelings.
Right, see, that's what I'm saying. And we go, well, if I don't have feelings, then I'm a Vulcan. You see, all we have is the dichotomy. We don't have any stories about, there's something above that we've never written about.
Yeah. See? I guess it's hard to imagine.
That's what it is. And it's sad to record that it's so hard for us to imagine. It's so hard for me to even figure out how I could talk about it. Or I'm not even sure if I know what I'm talking about. That's pretty sad to record. But I know, I know to not be satisfied with the vivid islands of heat anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, especially since it's so cold in the external world on this planet that in relative terms it doesn't take a very warm island for it to appear to be vivid in contrast. Okay? All right. And so this whole question is like, what is light in contrast to heat? What is that? I'm not totally sure, but I'm not going to be satisfied with heat anymore. I'm just not going to be. I'm going to keep seeking until I find light.
I mean, in physics, Brownian motion is not a photon.
Yeah.
Are there feelings on the eye?
Yes, you have feelings. I mean, you don't have animal feelings on high, of course. But sure, there's always feelings, right? But it's just, again, you always have a lower domain that has feelings, but there's an upper domain. And you want feelings that are predicated on light rather than feelings that are just under themselves.
I think the heat is a great way to put it.
Right.
I can really relate to that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, we all know that we have expressions like warm feelings. This is telling you right there that feelings are heat and not light. Right? You know, and when they say things like light without heat, see, it should get you thinking. It's like, what on earth is that? I thought that's all that light was little nuggets of heat. What's light without heat?
You say we know it.
Right?
It's not the polar light from the moon.
I'm just using that physical energy, fact about light without heat. I mean, see, there's an analogy with what I'm talking about, intellectually, mindily. What's the difference between mindal light in comparison to mindal heat? Right?
Illuminated thought.
Right. We know we kind of have this idea that, you know, we can have illuminated thoughts, right? I mean, that whole idea of spirit, shining a light on your mind. But see, to actually get to the actual light of that, rather than if your spirit superconsciously illuminates your mind, and then that casts a heat shadow, and you experience the heat shadow. See, and you sort of bathe in the heat shadow, but to actually say, okay, well, it's wonderful. I want to just lay here and like a kitty cat in the window ledge, okay, and soak up the warmth. But aren't you curious about where's this coming from? To go above the feeling of the warmth, the shadow, to recognize the light. To go towards the source of this, and that's what they're encouraging you to do. Because the light without the heat is in the upper domain. okay. All right, so we went through all of that. Let's see, anything else that we got off on that tangent to make sure we didn't... Let's see. Again, everyone is kind of familiar with kind of the poetry of this paragraph. Plunging the planet into such a hopeless state of confusion, all the more confounded by evil and sin. Oh, yeah, there's a good thing right there. Notice that Remember when we, that the self-confusing, self-disrupting, self-destroying, self-destruction, you know, parallel to error, evil, sin, and iniquity? Yeah. See how they're using confusion, all the more confounded by evil and sin. So in other words, error, all the more confounded by evil and sin. See the sequence there? Okay. All right, so let's get to the survival of Adam and Eve here.
Section 6, Survival of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve went to their mortal rest with strong faith in the promises made to them by the Melchizedeks that they would sometime awake from the sleep of death to resume life on the mansion worlds, worlds also familiar to them in the days preceding their mission in the material flesh of the violet race on Urantia.
So again, just before they explain all this fancy stuff that was done with Adam and Eve, special stuff, they died just like we all do, right? They went to their mortal rest with strong faith in the promises made to them. Okay, now, does that mean a strong belief in the promises made to them? No. All right, strong faith. All right, a validated belief. See how you completely can corrupt that sentence if you use what everyone thinks the word faith means. They went to their mortal rest with a strong, credulous belief, you know, in the promises that some preacher gave to them. And it's no. Right? Had nothing to do, you know, when all was said and done, yeah, the Melchizedek said some things to them, but they validated those things in their inner life. They knew. They didn't just know about this. They knew. Faith, there's a validation step there. So that's the important thing that they're stressing there. And that's what you want to strive for, is that kind of final state of your mind when you meet your mortal end. It's not predicated on wishful thinking that you're going to have a next life. You've validated that in the inner life. You can actually know that as a fact in the inner life, that the next life is not just wishful thinking. It's not just fairy tales. Right? And that all comes very naturally when you find all that's predicated on God knowingness on the sixth level, the level where there's genuine faith. That's that validation step. Okay.
And they had to know that they were going to die a mortal death, and it was their soul being resurrected. And
yeah.
Their soul was production of this life.
Yeah.
They didn't bring a soul from...
No. Yeah. See, what's going to wake up on the mansion world is not what left them. Right? That material mind left Gerasim and stuff. That material mind just died and is not resurrected. The mind that used to be on Gerasim is now gone. Right, the mind of Adam and Eve that gets resurrected in the mansion world is that Maranja mind that started here, a totally different mindal self than the mindal self that used to live there. Exactly. See, very important point. Right? In so many ways, it's a different self, see, that returns there. And the same is true with us. This mortal self that's talking to you right now is not going to be found on the first mansion world. This mortal self is going to die. And my immortal self, my Maranja self that you haven't talked to yet, is what you're going to talk to on the first mansion world. You know? And I'm trying to supply favorable conditions so that's at least a gross facsimile of the self that's talking to you right now. Okay. It's not just this embryonic thing. Okay.
They did not long rest in the oblivion of the unconscious sleep of the mortals of the realm. On the third day after Adam's death, the second following his reverent burial, the orders of Laniforge, sustained by the acting Most High of Edentia, and concurred in by the Union of Days on Salvington, acting for Michael, were placed in Gabriel's hands, directing the special roll call of the distinguished survivors of the Adamic default on Urantia. And in accordance with this mandate of special resurrection, number 26 of the Urantia series, Adam and Eve were repersonalized and reassembled in the resurrection halls of the mansion worlds of Satania, together with 1,316 of their associates in the experience of the first garden. Many other loyal souls had already been translated at the time of Adam's arrival, which was attended by a dispensational adjudication of both the sleeping survivors and of the living qualified ascenders.
Okay, number of technical things in there. I'm sure a number of questions are probably, but let's go through it one step at a time here. You gotta love how they start out. The oblivion, the unconscious sleep. And then, you know, they never explain this, but it's, you know, it's all over. You know, it's not just in this regard of resurrection, but there's some quite universal physics thing with the 3 days. Okay? I mean, yes, in terms of our resurrection, or even in theirs, I mean, they're not literally resurrected on the third day. Like, they got to be, their souls have to be transported, okay? But in terms of initiating a process that's, you know, extended out over a long time, technically, there's this 3 day thing all over the place in the book. You know, that's very mysterious. You know, and they notice they even throw in the technicality, and on the first day is not the day they were buried. The first day is the day they died. Okay, and again, it's not 3 days after; it's the third day. Right, you can count inclusively, right? Just like Friday, Saturday, Sunday with Jesus. Right, he's not resurrected on Monday; he's resurrected on Sunday. Right, it's the third day, not 3 days after. And so all those times when they say on the third day after, not 3 days after, right? You know, you're in that mode of accounting inclusively. You know, so these orders are done, you know, and they just don't ever explain why there is this pattern that's followed in so many areas, where there's the closing day and then the reopening day and then a rest day in the middle. I mean, you know, just do a search in the book for all the times it says, you know, the third day. And notice all the different contexts that exists in. So anyways, there it is again, with all its mystery.
And even though Eve died, how many years earlier? 17?
19.
They were both resurrected together.
Yeah.
So they use this third period.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, remember when they want to be technical about our resurrection specifically, right? They say third period because, again, the middle one can't be literally a day because it takes longer than that to transport you, right? So there's the day you died, the day you resurrected, but the quote unquote day in the middle, okay, is not just one day because you have to be transported, and. And we'll get to that at the very end there. Just some of the technicalities of resurrections are being brought up at the very end there. But let's make sure we get the other things in here. So after the third day, they give you there's the whole bureaucracy thing, like they so often give you, that everybody's got to check off on this. So it goes up the whole chain. And it's not going to be a millennial resurrection. It's the special one, right? That are just done whenever. Okay, so they didn't have to wait long. I mean, they didn't have to wait till the next millennial resurrection, whenever the heck that is. We don't know the boundary points of those. So they do a special one. They give you the interesting little tidbit that this is the 26th time they've done a special one.
Yeah.
And they did it for Adam and Eve. So that's just kind of interesting that there was 25 times when there were individuals that were, you know, you can think, well, you've got, you know, you've got some of the, you know, the leaders of the races, you know, St. Langton and, you know, et cetera. You know, maybe they did, you know, for them to get them to the mansion world right away or, but anyway, it's been done quite a few times.
Fun to try to back into those.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere there's a list. I mean, the midwares probably have the list. Yeah. But, you know, how many have been done since Adam and Eve? You know, brings in that whole question. You know of one. Ed, can anyone tell me? Moses, remember? And that's where, you know, if you go back, that's actually in, what paper is that? The Planetary Mortal Epics paper. That's paper 52, section 5. If you want to go back sometime and look, that's when they talk about Moses, you know, being brought over in a special resurrection. But that's also the spot where I wanted to remind you, I was remembering when you said, didn't want to forget. Remember the other thing that's going on here. This is post-rebellion and pre-Pentecost. That whole time, no one went as an independent ascender. It didn't matter if you were a first circler, right, on the verge of fusing. I mean, those that fused, okay, they went. But, you know, forget about third circler and you can go as a single individual. Remember, they tell you back there that there's a mysterious process that they don't explain that was interrupted. No one could go as a single ascender. Not even Moses, like they say. See? Okay.
Yeah,
so it doesn't matter. You know, if you were, you know, you could have been a total first circler, right? You know, you had to wait until a dispensational resurrection, or unless they brought you in one of these special ones or a millennial one. Okay, so yeah.
But with that way it's written, even Moses was not permitted to go over to the other side until the occasion of the special resurrection. The fallen planetary prince Caligastia contesting such a deliverance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. See that, and they say that the rebellion had suspended the procedure whereby mortals can pass upon death directly to the shores of the mansion worlds. Explain, please. No, they don't explain the physics of it. But see, again, there's something that, you know, they literally couldn't be done. You're going, well, could they put the soul and transport it? No, see, there's something that they literally couldn't do it until some additional spirit machinery or something was put in place at Pentecost.
So, okay. Like the quarantine situation.
Yeah, there's like we said, it's not just communication. There's more stuff to this. And that's the biggie that they mentioned.
Say other side and
yeah, right. Yep. All poetic like that. Okay, so anyway, yeah, so yeah, we don't know what circle Adam and Eve, you know, had made it to when they died. They obviously didn't fuse. Okay. So you know, wow, Enoch, you know, or Elijah got to fusion. And a lot fewer years than 530,
yeah.
Right, or 400. Again, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of issues with all that, like we've talked before. So, you know, you can wonder, I mean, what circle were they? But even see, if they were third circle or higher, they couldn't have gone just, yeah, you know, as a single ascender, because of this machinery is not in place, whatever it is.
A lot of being in a state of repentance and redemption, like that wasn't going to go away here. They'd have to have more of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, the rebellion didn't change the fact that you can move up the psychic circles and you can, you know, and even get to fusion, but, you know, getting to the next world, you know, is not a magical affair. It's, you know, it's got all kinds of technical issues to it that we don't understand. And did you have something else, Gene? Okay. All right, so that's between the lines. You know, it might... It could be one reason why this is number 26, not like number 2 or something, because there would be a lot of, you know, there are probably a lot of, you know, individuals that normally could go on their own that, you know, they had to get up there in a special resurrection. Okay, so there's all that. And then the final little zinger, if you haven't dealt with this before, it throws you for a curveball the first time. The whole bit about an adjudication. You don't just adjudicate the dead, like at a dispensational adjudication. You adjudicate the dead and the living. Okay? So there's a line that's drawn, right? And everyone that has died before that line and is alive before that line is adjudicated. You know, so like, you know, say 2,000 years ago, okay, you know, the last dispensational resurrection, everyone that was alive when they did that was adjudicated and was part of the, and was resurrected as part of that dispensational resurrection when they did die subsequent to that line.
Sure.
Okay, so they're part of that prior dispensation. So that reminds you again, see, that line is not just an arbitrary line. The physics changes on the other side of that line. And if you're conceived in that new physics, you're part of a totally different scheme.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, they don't explain any of this, right? They barely are allowed to even mention that there's all this spirit physics. Okay?
So Mary has been resurrected. Jesus' mother, after he has dispensation, because she dies afterwards.
Right, yeah, even though she dies afterwards, she was adjudicated at the time of that dispensational adjudication, see. You know, so not only Joseph, but Mary as well, part of that Jesus dispensation, along with... all the siblings, right? John the Baptist, right? All of them.
Before the dispensation.
Right, see, but again, see, that's just to recognize, it doesn't matter if you died before the dispensation. Everyone that's alive when that line is drawn is part of the adjudication, right? You know, and so when they say living qualified ascenders, what's the qualification? Do you have a soul?
Yeah.
Or not,
yeah.
Right? So, right. I mean, if you don't have an adjuster, and there's no soul, there's nothing to adjudicate. In fact, your blob of breathing protoplasm, right, is irrelevant. Okay, and, you know, this soul is being adjudicated. Not, you know, my mortal mind is never going to be adjudicated. My soul is judged. Right?
Dispensation, or you don't go?
Well, I mean, if you did get an adjuster.
Subsequent.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
But,
so do you have this flavor of adjudication, like going with you forward?
Yeah, see, so that brings in. Color your whole future.
Truth,
yeah, you're. Yeah. You were born into a certain type of domain, yeah, environment.
So interesting.
I know, and it's also mysterious. It really gets you thinking, what does that all imply?
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll understand a lot of that on the first mansion world once we have actually are dealing with the physics of spirit substance. Right? A lot of this will be understandable to us, what we're talking about here.
I can picture picture it kind of like clouds of a different color, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's just
I like that.
Something that you are. I mean, and this we'll actually see that this comes up again in the next paper when we think about the midwares coming into existence. Right? They're referring to all of this unrevealed physics stuff that's in play here too. It's in play with midwares coming into existence. So it's even gets even more intriguing and frustrating that they aren't allowed to really say anything specific about it. Yeah, remember the beings that control all this physics stuff, this spirit stuff, and its physics. You know, they weren't allowed to reveal them. They just disclosed their existence in passing a couple times. All the spirit controllers. You know, so. It's all this very unrevealed, mysterious stuff. But anyway.
Just one more thing.
Yep.
Reverend Theriel, I just wanted to
yes.
emphasize the word reverent.
Yeah.
Because you often say it's such a low thing, but it is used on high.
Reverence in and of itself is in the lower domain, but that doesn't mean it can't be reverence is predicated on something above.
So it is.
So
I
it's,
just want to emphasize
so it's
that.
A true reverence rather than just
right.
a mere reverence.
It's a true reverence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I notice sometimes people will say, apologize for the word reverence. And
again, you
there
just.
It's a true reverence.
Right. It's just, you know, to take all of these thoughts out of the dichotomy, you know, and think of them in the bottom up, top down. You know, you want reverence that's top down.
Right.
Because if it's bottom up, then that's all it is.
Yeah.
Right? And it doesn't matter how much reverence of unity you have from the bottom up, that's not the worship of God.
I don't think people get that, though.
But the worship of God will cast a shadow down as a sublime reverence of unity.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want
yeah.
people to know.
Right. It's important to. Yeah. It's always important to keep stressing to not interpret what I'm saying in dichotomies. Yeah. Or interpret the book in dichotomies. Yeah. Okay. All right. So in this context, you've got all of the ones that that they're resurrecting in this special resurrection, and then they mention, see, but you have some that were already resurrected in the dispensational adjudication,
500 years ago.
Even though they hadn't died yet. But you know they were alive, see, and you know, at the time of that adjudication. So some of the first garden crew made it up there in the dispensational one. You know, as the tail of that dispensational one. You know, those were getting resurrected after Adam and Eve arrived, but were of the previous dispensation. And then the ones that, you know, the others were resurrected in this special resurrection. Okay.
Adam and Eve quickly passed through the worlds of progressive ascension until they attained citizenship on Gerizim, once again to be residents of the planet of their origin, but this time as members of a different order of universe personalities. They left Gerizim as permanent citizens, sons of God. They returned as ascendant citizens, sons of man. They were immediately attached to the Urantia service on the system capital, later being assigned membership among the 420 counselors who constitute the present advisory control body of Urantia.
Yeah, as I think we all remember, they're part of the 420 counselors now. And again, stressing what we were just saying, I mean, these are, you know, not the selves that were there before. And notice how they say that, but this time as members of a different order of universe personalities. Did they have different literal spirit patterns from the Universal Father? Is that what they mean by different personalities? No. See, there's an example where personalities is short for personalized selves. Right? The personalities are the same, but the selves are different. It's not that material self anymore. It's that Marantia self. Personalized by the same spirit pattern. So just, it was just a simple example of, you know, you have to always, when they say personalities, are they talking about literally that spirit pattern, or are they? Is it shorthand for personalized self? You know, if you don't distinguish those two, you'll get very confused about what personality is in the book. Okay, all right, final paragraph here.
And thus ends the story of the planetary Adam and Eve of Urantia, a story of trial, tragedy, and triumph, at least personal triumph for your well-meaning but deluded material son and daughter, and undoubtedly in the end, a story of ultimate triumph for their world and its rebellion-tossed and evil-harassed inhabitants. When all is summed up, Adam and Eve made a mighty contribution to the speedy civilization and accelerated biologic progress of the human race. They left a great culture on Earth, but it was not possible for such an advanced civilization to survive in the face of the early dilution and eventual submergence of the Adamic inheritance. It is the people who make a civilization. Civilization does not make the people. Presented by Solonia, the seraphic voice in the garden.
Okay, before we deal with that very tail end, there's one other little thing. They never miss an opportunity for alliteration. Trial, tragedy, and triumph. Triple T there. And well-meaning but deluded. And again, you know, there's this false exaltation of self. It wasn't deliberate, but it was an exaltation of self nonetheless. They were deluded. It was self-righteous impatience at the default. Okay, so, and then, you got it, some more of the fun poetry about the nature of this world, rebellion-tossed, it's evil-harassed, etc. Then what by the time they get to the final sentence is very politically incorrect. It is the people that make a civilization. Civilization does not make a people.
Why is that politically incorrect?
That means you need to be discriminating about who you let into a country. All right? That's what's between the lines there, right? Civilization is a choice. And if you have marginal human minds, there isn't much choice possibility there, right? It can't be much besides society and culture. It can't be that unnatural thing of civilization. Right, so they're reminding you of that there at the end. And there's a limit. I mean, sure, it can be a lot of help to an individual to actualize more of their potentials if you take them out of a benighted environment and put them into a better environment. But civilization still does not make the people. Their genetics are not going to be altered because you brought them into a golden ruler's civilization. All right, so
maybe that's why they talk the example about you bring people from around the world into a center
and then send them back out.
Where they came from.
Yeah. Right. All right, there's a distinct limit, right, of how many people can be brought in and stay in if they don't inherently have that the ability to, in and of their own nature, to recognize and choose civilization. The civilization will be drugged down. I mean, it's happened over and over again, right? Why is there not the Athens of old anymore? Right? Genetics. Right? And you can go the fall of every civilization throughout all of human history, like the Revelators remind us, humans used to recognize that, but it's politically incorrect to even say that anymore. Right? I mean, why is Egypt not like it was in ancient times? Right? Genetics.
Well, thought it was because they dammed the Nile.
Right. You know, it's not because they dammed the Nile. It's not. Right. Yeah. And why is that so relevant? Because, you know, what are they going to be launching into? Right. I mean, the Andites. Right. That genetic stock that can produce people who can choose civilization. Adam and Eve came to uplift us to be a people that can choose civilization and transcend mere culture. Right? So
hardly anyone is choosing it, no matter where they come from.
Yeah, and see, and then if it gets even worse, you actually have an emergency. If those who technically have the potential to choose civilization get themselves so confused that they think civilization is a negative thing and avoid it willfully. Right. I mean, most universities are now teaching that the word civilization shouldn't be used, that that's a word that was coined as an oppressive word, right, for people who are falsely exalting themselves above others. Right. No, Adam and Eve didn't falsely exalt themselves. They lived to, you know, Adam died at 530. His genetics were a little above ours. Okay. And that's just a fact, but it's a, you know, it's a foreboden fact now. So, yeah, it's very much there, that reminder at the end, you know, of when all is said and done, the final statement here is, remember why Adam and Eve came, to uplift our genetics. Okay? And no amount of wishful thinking will alter any genetics. And it's a very difficult fact to face. You know, it's another reason why, you know, when those when people came to the New World, they didn't come to a civilized place and got civilized by it. They brought civilization with them. It was within them, genetically within them.
Civilization was a lot better in the 1800s. We went downhill from there.
Again, remember, even though we've got a lot fancier technology in the 20th century, you know, in the 21st century than in the 19th century, the philosophic integrity of civilization has evaporated. Mm-hmm. So it's an illusion. It appears that we're more civilized, but not really. You know, and It's now beginning to show very clearly, right, that we've been going on inertia, and we've ground down most of that inertia. And you see, it's now that you've kind of left all the people behind that were born, you know, in a culture that was cultivating the choice of civilization. Now that they've all basically died, you're seeing it. I mean, the decay is becoming exponential now. Right? It's just there's just no sense of why you would want to try to be civilized. And like I said, I mean, it's even worse than that. I mean, when you literally have people being taught in college that civilization is a concept that is in the opposite direction that you want to face.
They're being taught that.
That civilization, when you look in the direction of civilization, you're looking in a racist direction. Right? Yeah, I mean, that's why this book is in my lap. Right? See, it's this willful rejection that is fueling the exponential decay. Anyway, we'll have lots of time to talk about that as we get more into going forward in history. But it is important to notice that that's what they leave you with, is that very pointed reminder. Civilization does not make the people. All right, and before we get to that next time, we have this little delightful aside. A little bit of history, but mostly an aside about the Midway creatures. Because we want to remind ourselves that it isn't just humans that have a culture that's evolving on this planet. Parallel, the Midwayers have a culture. The permanent residents of this world. You know, we're just here today and gone tomorrow. But there's a whole evolving culture on this planet that's behind the scenes and has been around, in the case of the primary Midwayers, for a very, very long time. So we'll get into some of those details next time here. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.